If this happens, we'll be giving you stock in the company, I assured Bethany as she walked back into the studio. Namaste, she said, pressing her hands together and giving a bow, the kind I like, with irony. Pro tip. Think strategically about your schedule. Next up at Elvis's studio, we sat down with Danielle Monaro, a married mother of two with a chewy Bronx accent, tart attitude, and infectious giggle. Wearing blue jeans and a black sweatshirt emblazoned with the word love, she told us that when it came to meditation, she was also simply too busy. I'm in mommy mode, you know. I don't have time to breathe half the time. You want me to sit down and meditate? That wasn't to say she couldn't use it, she conceded. I feel like I have a lot of anxiety where I worry about stupid stuff that doesn't matter. I'll honestly be laying there in bed and I'll go, gosh, that fan sounds really, really loud. I hope it doesn't fly off the ceiling. Not everything that causes Danielle to wring her hands is irrational, of course. Being a parent, you constantly worry, she said. I get it. As a parent myself, I understand the sort of nameless unreasoning that can overtake you when, say, your kid is 5 minutes late coming home or when you find a swollen lymph node. As Danielle told us, what causes the most anxiety is the stuff you, quote, have no control over. Jeff assured her that letting go of things you cannot control is one of the biggest benefits of the practice. He said, you get more laissez-faire. You become more like an old lady, a wise old lady. Elvis doesn't want us to be old ladies, Danielle said as we all started laughing. I could be old on the inside. Inside, yeah, said Jeff. Cool grandma. Okay, that's cool. I'll be the cool grandma. But how to get her to actually do it? Our approach with Danielle, and this is something we recommend to anyone who's struggling with the time issue, was to ask her to step back and take a look at her overall schedule. There are almost certainly points in the day where she could spare a few minutes and where meditation would slot in nicely. I was just thinking as I listened to your schedule, I said to Danielle, that the best time might be right before you go to bed. She agreed. Jeff promised to make her a short, bespoke meditation that could be used anytime she had a free moment, including the moment before bed. I hope it works, she said, because that stupid ceiling fan is driving me nuts. As you think about your own schedule, bear in mind that some people find that having a set time every day, right before bed, first thing in the morning, just after a workout, really helps establish a habit. Scientists who study habit formation talk about cue, routine, reward. You can experiment with constructing a cue, routine, reward loop that gets you to meditate. For example, after I park my car, cue, I will meditate for 5 minutes, routine, and I'll feel a little calmer and more mindful, reward. Repeat this loop to ingrain the habit. You can even put it in your calendar, which some people find is a great way to cement the whole thing. That said, if, like me, you have an unpredictable schedule, it is absolutely fine to simply fit it in whenever and wherever you can. Pro tip. Give yourself permission to fail. It is impossible to overstate the importance of giving yourself the freedom to experiment, fail, and try again. Remember that we are wired to fail. Evolution has bequeathed us a brain that optimizes for survival and reproduction, not long-term health planning. If you get all overheated about whatever tactic you choose first and put too much pressure on yourself to make it work, you'll deplete your resiliency. It's helpful to approach habit formation with the same attitude we hope to employ during meditation. Every time you get lost, just begin again. Before we left, Elvis brought Jeff and me back on the air for a quick goodbye. By the way, Elvis said, people were wondering, is this an infomercial? We've given you a lot of free plugs here. I think some cash under the table is perfect. When we emerged from the building, I saw it for the first time. It was huge and orange, and it would be our home for the next week and a half. Our bus. This is ridiculous, I said. I love it. It had huge signs on each side that read the 10% Happier Meditation Tour. On the back, a smaller sign said, We may never arrive. Passers-by were taking pictures. I climbed aboard and beheld the interior. There were five main compartments. First, the driver's area, occupied by Eddie Norton, a shy, mountainous man who took his job very seriously, which I found reassuring. After Eddie's lair, a living space with ample seating and a tricked-out satellite TV and stereo system. Next, there was a mini kitchen and full bathroom. Then came the bunks, 12 of them, arranged in two rows of three on each side of the bus. They looked a little coffin-like, but I briefly lay down in the top bunk that had been assigned to me, and it was surprisingly comfy. Not that I would have wanted to see it under a blacklight. At the far rear, there was another sitting area, which the legendary George Clinton had apparently used as a bedroom suite when on the road with Parliament Funkadelic. No coffin beds for George. As I looked around at this preposterous bus and at all of my smiling, traveling companions, I was starting to feel a little giddy. Jeff wisely brought us all down to earth with a reminder of the stakes. He said, "Last night, doing that podcast with Josh Groban and suddenly realizing that 100,000 people might be actually finding their way to a practice that might help them, that was a hugely moving experience." I have met very few people who get more of a high out of service than Jeff. He learned this in part from his parents, who have dedicated much of their spare time to local charities, but it's also just in his character. Some professed altruists annoy me because I cynically suspect they don't actually mean it. In Jeff's case, though, it was clear to me that being useful was like oxygen, especially when it came to engaging one-on-one with meditation students. As he likes to say, there are no existential crises in those moments. Back on the bus, I added, "This is fun and goofy, and I love it. I'm obviously P.T. Barnum-esque, but what we're doing matters. If you could actually boost people's level of sanity by 10%, that is a massive value add." Fittingly, perhaps, our next stop was a place where I had once been utterly insane, at least according to my mother. Several hours after leaving New York City, the bus rolled into suburban Boston and pulled up at Newton South High School, my alma mater, where I could easily have been voted least likely to do anything mindful ever. Here we were, 26 years later, and hundreds of people had shown up to listen to me and Jeff speak about meditation. Before the talk, Jeff and I chatted with my parents backstage. They were both in their early 70s, but still deeply engaged in their medical careers. "Did you guys see the plaque they put up for my academic excellence here?" I asked them. "No, are you kidding me?" asked my mother incredulously. I was definitely kidding. Suffice it to say, I had been neither athlete nor mathlete. "You were getting D's in math," my mother reminded me. My dad chimed in, clearly enjoying exposing my miscreant past in front of Jeff and all the cameras. The irony was, years later, he asked us why we didn't make him study more. Now they were really working themselves up into a lather. One day he said to me, "Why didn't you guys make me work harder in high school?" related my mother, grabbing her head in mock exasperation as everyone laughed. "We were trying to keep you out of jail." She was only partly exaggerating. During my high school years, I was a prodigious pot smoker and dedicated class cutter. I also had a robust career spray-painting graffiti onto the walls that lined the local subway tracks. My mom says she endured a years-long stretch during which she never once saw me smile. "You were so angry," she said. Too bad she didn't have a meditation practice back when she clearly could have used it. She does have one now, though, because her son, the former delinquent, introduced her to it. She does 15 minutes a day, often with her cat Harry by her side. She told us it gives her, quote, "the ability to step back and see what's going on instead of just reacting to it. I always had a pretty short fuse." I don't recall her having a short fuse. What I do remember is her making elaborate DIY Halloween costumes for my brother and me and also insisting that we not watch TV, for which I believe I have exacted ample revenge by way of my current career. True, my mother has an intimidating, suffer-no-fools intelligence, but she is by no means as prone to anger as her father, Robert Johnson. "I'm not as bad as he was," she said, "but I have a tendency to take things personally, worry about what other people are thinking, worry and worry and worry about if I'm doing well enough, if I'm working hard enough, how far behind I am, the usual obsessive type A personality stuff." While my mother had found the practice useful, my father was not meditating. "He says he doesn't need to," said my mom, chuckling. He's got perfect equanimity. I find napping is an equivalent, said my dad impishly. Jeff and I took the stage in the auditorium, which was set with an oriental rug and a pair of large potted plants. It looked like an episode of Between Two Ferns. In the audience, I spotted a few of my high school classmates, buddies from a group of friends my parents had facetiously referred to as the Brain Trust. They, too, had managed to stay out of jail. I held forth for a while about the benefits of mindfulness. Jeff led us in a brief meditation. Then we opened the floor up for questions. Very quickly, we got to the issue of time. A sharp young professional named Chris approached the mic, admitting that he was mildly nervous about doing so. I hope I don't have a panic attack right now, said Chris. You haven't been doing any cocaine, have you? I asked. No, he assured me. And then he said, I'd like to ask you about time management. He had started meditating as an undergrad and had been sitting 5 times a week for about 20 minutes. Now, though, he was working at a competitive financial firm and finding that he was only sitting 2 times a week. How could he find more time to do it? Pro tip. 1 minute counts. You should start thinking about short meditations, I told Chris. I think 1 minute counts. As discussed, if you only have the time or the motivation for a 60-second sit, you should chalk it up as a win. One of the trickiest parts of habit formation is getting the new behavior anchored into your life. Once that is done, you can tinker with the amount of time you sit. What's more, after 1 minute of meditation, people often think to themselves, I'm already here, might as well keep it going a bit. As the meditation teacher Corey Mascara argues, this is a key moment because you're moving from extrinsic motivation, that is, meditating because you feel like you have to the much more powerful intrinsic motivation, that is, meditating because you want to. The second you opt in for more meditation, you're doing it out of actual interest, which makes it much more likely to have a lasting effect. So if you're struggling to find time to meditate, look for opportunities for this kind of quickie. After you brush your teeth, after your morning coffee, after you park your car at work, after you sit down on the train, after you put your head down on the pillow. You get the picture. As Jeff argues, 1 minute counts because it only takes 1 second to disembed from a difficult emotion or thought pattern. So here's Jeff with a 1 minute meditation you can use anytime, anywhere.
This is a busy person's meditation. 10 breaths, that's it. A modest 1 minute reset, intended to take some of the wind out of the sails of whatever storyline you've been racing around in. The idea is simple. Wherever you are, in any situation or mental state, count 10 long, slow breaths.
So, to be clear, the thing my mother told me to do when I was a tantruming toddler is actually a meditation?
Yes. The only difference is we're adding some adult curiosity about the process. In particular, the process of shifting attention from our mental preoccupations to our breath. We're going to see if we can deliberately let our stories fade out, like the story, say, that some of us tell about not having enough time to meditate, or the more general, I'm so busy freneticism that a great many of us live inside. We'll try to let the thoughts fade, even as the feeling of the breath gets richer and more real. 10 good breaths, a meditation. 1 minute or longer. Start by stopping. Wherever you are, lying in your bedroom, parked in your car, standing in an elevator, try it with your eyes open, but keep your gaze soft. It's the perfect stealth meditation. In this practice, we're intentionally controlling the first few breaths, breathing more deeply than normal, exaggerating the airflow to help us feel it more. So, big inhale. 1. Counting breaths helps us pay attention. Make the out-breath nice and long. See if you can let it be a release so your whole body softens as the diaphragm relaxes. For the next few in-breaths, experiment with holding the air for a moment. As you breathe out, imagine you're breathing out whatever worry or concern may have been spinning around in your head. After 3 or 4 breaths like this, move into breathing normally. As you count each breath, get interested in how fully you can feel the sensation of breathing, its softness and rhythm. Really try to get into it as you stand there in the elevator, staring into space, grooving on your breath. Notice how you're able to shift the ratio of your attention so that your thoughts get less loud and insistent as your breath gets more pronounced. Notice how as we focus in, the visual world kind of washes out. Keep counting. You can make it to 10. If you get distracted and forget where you were, start over from where you got lost, always with a sense of humor. How patient can you be with each breath? No rush. Breathing like you've got all the time in the world. See if you can enjoy the simplicity of the activity as everything else fades into the background. When you get to 10, notice any feelings of settledness and calm that might be there. Retune into your surroundings. Welcome back. You can come here anytime. Now, leave the elevator. Cheat sheet. 1. Stop. Wherever you are. Bring your attention to breathing. Count 1 as you inhale. Imagine breathing out any tension as you exhale. Count 2 on the next inhale. 2. See if you can make it to 10 without losing your focus. Explore how fully you can feel each breath, letting the world around you fade out a bit. 3. If you get distracted and forget where you are, start over from where you got lost, always with a sense of humor about your tragic, gnat-like attention span.
Pro tip, free-range meditations. The other piece of advice we gave to Chris, the young businessman who spoke up at the Newton South event, was that if you can't find time to do formal meditation, you can co-opt your everyday life activities, walking between meetings, brushing your teeth, doing dishes, and turn them into mini meditations. Jeff has some advice about how to transform your daily activities into what I like to call free-range meditation.
So the classic meditation visual is eyes closed, legs crossed, ass planted on the cushion or chair in a quiet room. And that's fine. The cushion is the lab, or if you prefer, the gym. It's where you train and experiment in a relatively simple and distraction-free environment. But most people don't pump iron in the gym so they can feel good pumping iron in the gym. The idea is to bring your healthy body into your life. Well, the same is true of meditation and the mind. For this reason, some teachers and traditions deliberately emphasize meditation techniques that are meant to be practiced in the world. And that's what this little section is about. The good news is you can pretty much meditate on anything. Sounds, sights, tastes, touches, feelings, any sensation. That's because it's less about the meditation object and more about the qualities of attention. Like, for example, concentration and equanimity that you bring to that object. These qualities are like muscle groups of the mind. They can be trained. The training of specific mental qualities is an important idea. One will continue to develop as we proceed through the book. We've already spoken quite a bit about the training of concentration. The following meditations tap the same concentration muscle, but they also emphasize the curiosity muscle, which ultimately leads to more clarity about what's going on in our experience. Clarity is like dialing up the resolution knob on an old-fashioned TV set. Here are some simple examples. Free-range meditations. Walking through sound, a meditation. 10 seconds or longer. We have a full walking meditation in Chapter 8, which focuses on the physicality of walking. This is a meditation that focuses on the auditory aspect of walking. I do it all the time because, apparently, I'm a weirdo. The next time you're walking anywhere, inside or out, just notice sounds. So part of your attention, of course, is on making sure you don't get run over by a bike courier, but part of it is on the full ambient soundscape, the rise and fall of voices, the distant hum of traffic, the summertime buzz of cicadas. You are deliberately shifting attention away from the inner world of thoughts and feelings to the outer world of sound. Try not to get too caught up in identifying what's making the sounds. You don't need to know what you're hearing, only that you are hearing. How weird hearing is happening. You are living in ear world. Round sounds, sharp sounds, crisp sounds. Warble, warble, whoop, warble, honk, warble. Explore how long you can keep your attention on the odd balloon of sound that moves and shifts and undulates along with you. When you get distracted by sights, sensations, or thoughts, notice this. And then notice what it's like to notice this. Electric awareness, wake up, snap. I am mindful, you might say in a droid-like voice, perhaps moving stiffly like C-3PO to the joy of passing children. Then, start again. Shower, a meditation. 10 seconds or longer. Shift your attention to the sensation of warm water flowing over your body. Can you experience the water as a massage? Zoom in on the little pressure changes, on the individual streams against your skin. Stay with exactly what's happening. Try not to get lost in a daydream. Now, this is already a good enough meditation, quite lush and sensual, to say nothing of wet. But I like to add an extra something to test my openness. I'll start by noticing the receptivity of my body to the warm water, pores open, body relaxed, and then I'll switch the water to cold and see if I can maintain the same open attitude. So not bracing or rigid, but letting the cold flow into and through me. As with cold water, so with life. How long can you keep your composure?
Okay, I need to pop in here and comment that this is a seriously strange and masochistic meditation.
It's equanimity training. Helpful for managing discomfort of all kinds. Zen monks do it under ice-cold waterfalls while a single Japanese flute plays in the distance. Toothbrushing. A meditation. 10 seconds or longer. Who the heck pays attention to brushing their teeth? Normally we're on automatic pilot as we do this, grinding down our gums as we mentally rehearse our day. In this sense, toothbrushing is terra incognita. See if you can slow the whole activity right down, squeezing the toothpaste, first contact, the rhythmic flexion of the bristles on your teeth. How much detail can you feel? How into it can you get? Can you brush your teeth like Jimi Hendrix played guitar, eyes closed, hips flung forward, blotter of acid under your terry cloth headband? A bunch more free-range meditation ideas. Meditation is basically the end of boredom. Standing in line at the ATM? Meditate on the feeling of your feet on the ground. Sitting on a bus? Soften your gaze and meditate on the flowing movement of color and form. Bored out of your mind at a dinner party? Meditate on the sound of clinking silverware or the taste of the food, chewing slowly, eyes closed, in a way that's guaranteed to disturb the other guests. Having sex? Meditate on the feeling of stunned gratitude and incredulity. The possibilities are endless. As you go about your day, look for opportunities to shift the ratio of your attention from thinking and planning to hearing and seeing and touching. If you get distracted, get curious about the experience of realizing that you've been distracted. This mini realization is a literal rehearsal for bigger realizations that can happen down the line in meditation. Wake-ups are all the same, only the size of them is different. And like I've said, it's so important to take a moment to feel satisfaction when you wake up. With mindfulness, we're training our ability to choose how we want to pay attention. Each wake-up is a new moment of choice. Many teachers argue it's the only place real choice ever happens. Last thing, while free-range meditations can be fun and useful, the whole point of having a meditation practice, after all, is to have mindfulness metastasize throughout your whole life. It's easier to make mindfulness in daily life exercises work if you have a base of formal seated practice in which you're doing nothing but training your capacity to stay present to what's happening.
Pro tip, adopt an attitude of daily-ish. A woman in the balcony at the Newton South event chimed in with a concept I had never heard before. She said her meditation teacher told students that they should aim to be meditating daily-ish. We might have to steal that, I said. I always worry that if you're overly rigid about dailiness, it can backfire. It sets up a situation where if you miss a day or two, the voice in your head, that slippery little storyteller, can weasel in and whisper, "You're a failed meditator," and then boom, you're done. Daily-ish actually has some elasticity, I think, to lead to an abiding habit, I said to my new friend in the cheap seats. Thank you. Appreciate it. Elasticity is a key concept from behavior change research. Scientists call it psychological flexibility. A related example that Jeff uses when it comes to his diet is the 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, he eats healthy food, and the rest of the time, he eats whatever he wants. This way, he rarely feels deprived. It's like a steam release valve. I liked this concept so much, I instituted my own version, the 60-40 rule. Pro tip, the accordion principle. Another way to inject a dose of elasticity into your practice is something I call the accordion principle. It's a combo of one-minute counts and adopt an attitude of daily-ish. If your goal is to do 5 to 10 minutes a day of meditation, one way to give yourself a break on really busy days is to do just 1 minute. It's another hack that allows you to keep your foot in the game and prevent the turkey in your head from offering up pseudo-wisdom along the lines of, you fell off the wagon, you're a hopeless case, give up now before you embarrass yourself further. Pro tip, make yourself accountable to other people. Behavior change scientists tell us that while some people will not institute a healthy habit on their own, they will do it when other people are holding them accountable. One way to create this kind of accountability is to join a community of some sort. This is a huge emphasis for Jeff, who helped start a meditation group in Toronto. As he told the crowd at Newton South, it can be as simple as this. Just get a few of your friends together and start. Another option is to join a regular sitting group at your local meditation center, assuming you have one in your area. It's like going to yoga or the gym, said Jeff. Now you're there. You gotta do it. Joining a community confers benefits that go well beyond accountability. In my experience, hanging out with other meditators sets up a kind of HOV lane effect. Being around people who take the meditative principles seriously and are endeavoring to apply these concepts in their own lives can create positive peer pressure, or, as Jeff says, it sort of normalizes the whole weird thing. Speaking personally, while I always enjoy sitting in groups, my unpredictable schedule makes it hard to create a reliable accountability structure. What's more, I've never been much of a joiner. However, I have found that it's enormously valuable to have friends who are interested in meditation. These friendships can run deeper, in part because regular meditators, people who make it a practice to step out of their automatic routines and who are no longer operating from behind such a thick filter of egoic thoughts, have more room to connect with others. There's a great story about the Buddha's right-hand man, Ananda. One day, Ananda was hanging out with some friends, talking about practice. Invigorated, he returned to the Buddha and declared that having friends like these was, quote, half the holy life. The Buddha quickly corrected him, saying, it's the whole of the holy life. For the record, I don't think these guys were using holy in the metaphysical sense. You could probably just replace it with the word good. Finally, if, like me, you are not a joiner, there is another powerful way to establish accountability. Create a relationship with a meditation teacher. Personally, I am lucky enough to have a long-standing relationship with an extraordinary teacher named Joseph Goldstein, who knows my mind well and has managed to keep me on track, even though I'm an attentionally challenged hedonist with trouble sitting still. If you want to find a teacher, I recommend you sample a class at your local meditation center and see if it's a good fit. You can also check online for a teacher who is willing to connect via video chat. My favorite moment of our visit to Newton came about midway through the event when a woman named Carla, a mom with moxie, came to the mic and let me have it. Carla was aware of a fact that I have not yet revealed to you, for fear that you might conclude that I am, how shall I say this, fucking bonkers. I meditate for 2 hours a day. Allow me to explain. I made the decision to dramatically increase my daily dosage of sitting after having meditated for several years and after having written a whole book about it. I did it primarily because I had had the privilege of hanging around with many people who are long-term, dedicated meditators and seeing how cool and seemingly happy many of them are. This made me deeply interested, both personally and journalistically, in what lies beyond 10% happier. In case you're curious, by the way, Jeff does about 35 minutes of formal sitting practice on most days, but it's worth noting that he's been at this significantly longer than I have, has spent way more time on retreat, and is, frankly, a bit maniacal about peppering his days with all kinds of mindfulness in action practices. Carla, who had heard me discuss my two-hour-a-day habit on my podcast, simply could not fathom how, as a fellow parent and busy professional, I had managed to squeeze in this volume of meditation every day. The biggest obstacle for me, she said, is I have two young kids and they have this like radar. I crawl out of bed so quietly in the morning. I just shuffle one foot over to my cushion and they sense it and they're there. She had a great comic delivery and the crowd was laughing along. Then she turned on me. I think a lot about your wife. I've never met her, but I've heard you talk about how long you meditate each day and I'm like, wow, she puts up with that? Now she really had the crowd. Jeff was beaming with glee and bowing in Carla's direction. My husband, I love him, she continued, but as much as I want him to be enlightened, I want him to unload the dishwasher. If he's like, I'm going to meditate for an hour, I'd be like, no, you're really not. Her question to me was simple. How do I pull this off, and what advice did I have for parents? I let the laughter subside and then cracked wise. One thing immediately that I think would be an easy fix is, have you thought about giving your kids up for adoption? I will always take the low-hanging joke. Then I actually answered her question. First, I said, I have a very understanding wife. I won't lie, my decision to go to 2 hours a day definitely created some tension initially, in part because I made the supremely unwise decision to unilaterally institute my new policy while we had a 6-month-old around the house. But by the time of the Newton South event, I'd been doing my 2-hour-a-day thing for about 18 months, and Bianca and I had figured out a system that mostly worked. As I told Carla, we talk about it. I often say, how can we do this so it's not coming out of your bank account? Meaning, how could I do this without making it so that Bianca was constantly left to fend for herself with our child? I pulled it off largely by being strategic about my daily schedule, as per the pro tip, think strategically about your schedule. I allow myself to sit whenever I can, wherever I can, and in as many intervals as I want. In some ways, my chaotic schedule has been helpful. I work GMA on the weekends and Nightline several nights during the week. Plus, I travel a ton. So this means I can sneak in quick meditations early in the morning or late at night. I also sit while I'm on airplanes, in the backseat of taxis, or even in my office. When I'm home, I try never to meditate if my son is awake, so I fit it in during the day when he's not around. If by the end of the day I have not gotten to 2 hours, I forego a few minutes of sleep, or I make it up the next day. I admit that it's all a bit nutty, but I seem to be muddling through. I realize, of course, that not every parent has this option, which is why I told Carla, you're at a point now where you need to write yourself a permission slip that says, okay, I'm not going to get a ton of meditation done right now, but can you find those little spots? A man in the audience weighed in with a tip he had picked up from his wife. She meditates in her car in the parking garage at work, he said. Her mistake, though, she finally shared that with her senior management team, and now they know where to find her. Back to my 2 hours a day thing. There is no question in my mind that it has deepened my practice and improved my life. Sustained sitting time has allowed me to see my inner patterns with finer resolution, helping me better understand my own mind and giving me increased empathy for how crazy we all are. I also, and this is going to sound a bit Jeffy, feel that peering inward with greater frequency has enabled me to bump up against fundamental truths. Everything is impermanent, and therefore clinging is a recipe for suffering, and mysteries. Who the hell is the I, the Dan, who is observing it all? Despite the fact that going to 2 hours created some initial domestic turbulence, Bianca says it has been really good for our relationship. My resting post-meditation face is more open and approachable. I take more of an interest in her day, and I exhibit more patience with the cacophony of parenting. The only potential downside, as she has joked, is that I meditate so much that she feels she doesn't have to. I don't want to sugarcoat it, though. Finding the time can be a serious pain, which is why my daily mega dose is not for everyone. And remember, I started with just 5 minutes a day. Pro tip. Novel idea. Try enjoying meditation. There was an even more deeply humbling moment toward the end of the night when Jeff pointed out that for all the tips and tricks we were throwing out to get people to meditate, we had been missing a big one. He asked, how many people here meditate because they enjoy it? A surprising number of people, to me at least, raised their hands. There's another thing going on here, which is just the pure enjoyment of sitting in your body, said Jeff. Everything in our culture is about external rewards, he added. But in fact, you've got it all right here. He motioned toward his torso. To be able to take a moment to sit back and feel what it feels like to be a human being is a privilege. While Jeff's riff earlier in the day about enjoying your beingness had fallen a bit flat for me, this one managed to hit home. Dismiss it as woo-woo if you want, but there is genuine power in tuning in to the blazingly obvious fact that you are alive. It reminded me of that sketch from Saturday Night Live where Dan Aykroyd plays President Jimmy Carter fielding live phone calls on the radio. A freaked out teenager named Peter calls in and says, I took some acid. I'm afraid to leave my apartment and I can't wear any clothes and the ceiling is dripping. Aykroyd slash Carter responds by telling Peter to take some vitamins, drink a beer, and listen to the Allman Brothers. Just remember, you're a living organism on the planet and you're very safe. It also reminded me of how when I had looked at the videos of Jeff and me from our wandering retreat a few months prior, he'd always had this goofy yet awesome look on his face when he was meditating, like he was actually having a good time. My mug, by contrast, looked all pinched from the effort. Sitting there with Jeff on that stage, I realized that while I did have truly pleasurable, fascinating, and meaningful moments in meditation, my daily scramble to get in my 2 hours had too often taken on the feel of a forced march. I was overlooking what could be the most powerful motivator of them all, and it stung. I turned to Jeff and admitted, I don't meditate because it feels good. I meditate because, I'm just supposed to do it. I'm noticing that about you, said Jeff. We've got to work on that. Ouch. I knew he didn't mean it as a criticism. He meant that enjoyment is something you can train. Good thing I was about to spend the next week and a half cooped up on a ridiculous bus with one of the best meditation teachers in the world. Speaking of Jeff, in his role as MacGyver, he devised a meditation specifically to help you build the muscle of enjoyment. Here he is.
Okay, so for this meditation, we'll continue to work with the breath, but we'll expand to include the sense of our physical body as well, enjoying the body.
So when I hear that term, enjoying the body, I feel like you're going to start talking about something lewd.
Dan, that's because you're a talking head on television, completely disconnected from your body. I used to be the same. For years, my body was just an appendage my mind dragged around behind me, forcing it to do stupid shit. Meditation helped me get back in touch, and enjoyment, we'll learn, is a key skill.
All right, your point is very well taken, but just to be super, super clear about this, you are saying that enjoyment is trainable like concentration.
The two are actually related. The more we enjoy a sensation, the more concentrated we can become, which in turn increases the enjoyment. So it's a feedback loop, part of working smart. And enjoyment, by the way, doesn't mean you're blissed out topless on a cushion covered in massage oil. It's a little more modest than that.
Thank you for putting that image in my head. Example, please, of how it's more modest than that.
Try to notice the sensation of air on the back of your hands right now. Can you find something very subtly pleasant about that?
Okay, yeah, I guess. But you're setting a pretty low bar with that.
That's all you need to get on the enjoyment gradient. It's basically an attitude, the capacity to appreciate something a hair above neutrality. You don't need enjoyment to benefit from meditation, but it can deepen the effects.
So let me just pipe in here again to channel the voices of our neurotic listeners. and I would count myself among them. The moment you say, this is all about enjoyment, you can pretty much guarantee that half the listeners are going to be experiencing annoying discomfort and persistent itches in places they never knew they could have itches.
Totally fine. Enjoyment, simply an option that might be available. Our primary task, let's not forget, is to concentrate on the breath or the body and to accept any other sensations that may be there in the background. Equanimity is a training to face the whole of experience, including any boring or uncomfortable parts. But then, just for fun, we see if there isn't actually something a wee bit enjoyable about the breath and the body, even with those itches and pains and tensions in the background. Enjoyment is more an attitude than anything else. And our attitudes can radically change the way we experience things. So do the experiment. Decide ahead of time to be open to enjoyment. But don't chase it. Let it come to you. It's important to keep it light. We don't want to compromise our equanimity by getting all hedonistic and pigging out on the good feels. We're learning the delicate art of experiencing pleasurable sensations without grasping and painful sensations without pushing. This is one of the primary skills of mindfulness, something we'll come back to again and again.
All right, one more question. What if it doesn't work?
If it doesn't work, don't worry about it. As I said, you can still get plenty of benefits. Enjoying the body, a meditation. 5 minutes or more. Close your eyes or keep them half open and take a few deep breaths. Each exhale is an opportunity to smooth out the lines of the face a bit, to relax the throat and the shoulders. Try to notice any settling that happens on the exhale, the way the diaphragm relaxes, or the way the body sinks in exhaustion because, frankly, you're working too hard and you should meditate more. Focus on the sensation of breathing at the nose or the chest or the belly. You can use a note here if you like. In, out, or rising, falling. Breathe naturally like you've done a billion other times in your life. Except this time, you're doing it with the attitude of deciding to find this experience enjoyable instead of practicing within the Dan Harris School of Funereal Endurance. It can feel nice just to breathe. Again, nothing dramatic, just a hair above neutrality. So there are different ways to connect to this enjoyment quality. It may be that the sensation of breathing is already subtly pleasurable for you, in which case, just run with that, focusing on exactly that soft and subtle quality. Or sometimes a bit of mental reframing helps. For example, you might connect to the idea that oxygen is filling you with vitality, or that the breathing is a kind of massage for your insides, or just that it feels good to be a large bipedal ape with a healthy and operational set of lungs. As always, you're allowed to completely fake it until at some point you accidentally find that some understated quality of enjoyment may indeed be happening. And if no enjoyment arises, no problem. It's simply an option. After a few minutes, shift your attention to the sense of your whole body sitting. Try to notice that this feeling of your breath is rising and falling inside this larger feeling of your body. Anytime you notice any uptightness about anything, breathe out and soften through your front. Can you bring a subtle sense of enjoyment to being in your body? The sexy, invigorating animality of it all. Smiling helps, even a non-committal Mona Lisa half-grin. Appreciating the existential hilarity of sitting with your eyes closed in your living room or wherever, tripping out on the feeling of having a body. So you're still focused on the sensation of breathing, only now you've widened the bandwidth a bit, so you're aware of your body too. If thoughts and sounds pass through this container, no worries. In fact, screw them. Screw those thoughts, but screw them in a friendly, enjoyable way, not hating on them. It's more like you don't give a toss one way or another. Thoughts and sounds just passing by, but you're grooving on the feeling of breathing and having a body, like a pleasure-loving hippie truant at an Allman Brothers show. No one ever needs to know. Enjoying the breath, the body, the meditation. When you're almost done, stop meditating altogether and just sit or lie back with your eyes closed for a few minutes. Relaxing, enjoying the rest. When you're ready, open your eyes. The real learning with meditation is always how it affects you in the world. you can explore bringing an attitude of relaxed enjoyment to any activity anytime. Walking, moving your hands, exercising, even lying down and stretching luxuriously like a jungle cat. Lots of folks do this instinctively. Why not do it intentionally? We need reasons to reinforce life's easy positives, to counter what some contemplative neuroscientists like to call the brain's negativity bias, which is the near universal human tendency to overfocus on the slings and arrows of fortune. This is one relatively straightforward way to do this. And as with everything, it gets easier with practice. Cheat sheet. 1. Breathe normally and try to tune into the soft feeling of inhaling and exhaling. If it helps, note in as you breathe in and note out as you breathe out. 2. Bring an attitude of enjoyment to the activity. Maybe there's a sense of refreshment when you inhale, or relaxation when you exhale, or some part of the sensation that feels kind of nice. Fake it if necessary. Pretend you're on drugs. 3. After a few minutes, shift your attention to the feeling of your whole body sitting. Imagine relaxing into your body like you're relaxing into a hot tub, opening to whatever body sensations are present. Pro tips. Be comfortable. Sit in an easy chair if you have to, or a couch. When the body is relaxed, everything is more enjoyable. You can also do this meditation lying down, but know that you may fall asleep. Related to this, you can alter your environment to make things more agreeable. Many practitioners create a cozy go-to meditation spot with candles and a plant and whatever sights and smells and sounds please them. I highly recommend doing the same if you can. Or make it a movable feast. Sit under a tree, or in a bath, or in a bed with a warm cup of tea in your hands. Explore a simple visualization. You can use your creativity to make practice more enjoyable. That's totally legit. Imaginative ideas can be a powerful way to frame and shape your experience. So you can imagine breathing up from the ground, or your body becoming suffused with light, or dissolving into a warm bath. What do you think all those ancient forest monks did before they had Netflix? Get sensual. You can enjoy the body the way you enjoy any other sensual pleasure. You can either just tune into a sensation and decide to find it delightful, or you can scan the body looking for subtly pleasurable feelings that may already be there, like tingling in the hands, or the automatic relaxation of the diaphragm on the exhale. To repeat, the key to enjoying sensations isn't to grasp at them, but to let them come to you. It's a practice of receiving. For some people, this comes naturally. For others, it's harder to grok. That's okay. It's one reason we practice.
After the talk in Newton, Jeff and I mingled with the crowd, took questions, and posed for seemingly endless selfies. I sometimes get slightly uncomfortable in these situations, especially if people profess to have liked my book. I feel like I might let them down in person. Also, even though as a needy anchorman I enjoy the attention, my emotional reserve can run dry at the end of a long day. My wife could write a whole book on this subject. Jeff, by contrast, appears to have a lot more gas in his tank, so to speak. As I peered over at him standing near the other side of the stage, schmoozing with audience members and giving them tips on their meditation practice, he was clearly having a blast. Later, I walked the halls of my old school with three members of the Brain Trust, Larry, Jason, and Dave. Larry and I had been best friends since age 2. We walked to school together every day, and when we were in a fight, we walked on opposite sides of the street. Jason and I used to spray paint graffiti tags on local train stations. Dave had been the captain of the football team back in the day and now worked here at our alma mater coaching lacrosse. As Dave showed us around, he pointed out that much of the school had been remodeled. Even the parts that hadn't changed looked utterly unfamiliar to me, though. "I don't remember anything," I said. "You didn't spend a lot of time here," said Dave, smiling. While the physical plant didn't provoke any memories, simply being with my friends did. I recalled the time when we tied Dave to the banister in his front hallway so he couldn't make it to class, or the multiple times when we used to pull the fire alarm outside of Larry's house and then hide in the woods and watch him explain himself to the firefighters. Oh, and my favorite hijinks calling local fast food restaurants and claiming to be managers from nearby franchises that had run out of burgers. We would then send in one of our buddies to collect the patties so we could have a barbecue. As Dave wrapped up his tour, he brought us to the place where our group of friends had kept our lockers. As I stared at this scene of numberless intrigues, alliances, and heartbreaks, I suddenly found myself confronting a completely different issue related to time. Not how to find the time to meditate, but instead how to come to terms with the fact that so many years had already whipped by in my own life. "Feels like a long time ago," I said. 1989's pretty far away, fellas," said Dave, which we greeted with a bittersweet belly laugh. The 1989 version of me would not have been able to imagine the middle-aged dad who stood here now. In my early 20s, during my first job in television in Bangor, Maine, where most of the people on staff were right out of college, we referred to one of the other reporters, a guy in his late 20s, as Jurassic Mark. Now here I was, in my old high school, at 45, slightly punch drunk from the passage of time and wincing slightly at my own image in all those selfies I'd just taken because my inner Robert Johnson said my features looked pointy and Tolkien-esque. But here's the thing about meditation. As Jeff's longtime teacher, Shinzen Young, says, meditation extends your life, not necessarily by making you live longer, but by boosting your level of focus so that you're squeezing more juice out of every moment. It does something else, too. As Jeff had said quite eloquently during the event, meditation, quote, accelerates the aging gracefully gradient. He said, you can age badly and you can age well. I know affable older folks who sit in the park and watch the kids play, and they've got that good-natured, easygoing quality. A serious practice just makes that happen sooner in your life, so you have it in the middle of your life or even earlier. You get to have the best of being old while you're still a little more sprightly. Yes, that is why we do this. Shortly thereafter, we loaded onto the bus for a long overnight drive. Sousa Tallon, a staffer at the 10% Happier Company, had instituted a count-off system to make sure we didn't lose anybody. We used numbers, and I was number 10. It was fun to listen to everyone call out their numbers. It almost made me feel young again after having been so powerfully reminded of my infirmity by the visit to my high school. I was a little worried about the next day, though. Some of the people we were supposed to be interviewing were bailing on us at the last minute, ironically, because of the very obstacle we were hoping to confront next. Chapter 4. People might think I'm weird. Representative Tim Ryan bounded into the room, shaking hands, repeating names, and making eye contact like the seasoned Paul that he is. Jeff and I, with our entourage in tow, had come to the congressman's office because he's a bona fide, out-of-the-closet meditator. He is also, by almost any objective measure, one of the most normal, non-weird American male specimens you could imagine. A hulking former quarterback, a practicing Catholic, and a moderate Democrat who represents a Rust Belt district in Northeast Ohio. And yet none of that had inoculated Ryan against the barbs of meditation skeptics. The Atlantic had dubbed him Congressman Moonbeam. Sitting next to Jeff on the couch in Ryan's office, I asked the congressman whether this kind of unflattering headline was hobbling his efforts to enlist his fellow legislators. "I think so, totally," he said. "You have enough bullshit you have to deal with throughout the course of your political life that answering a question about practicing mindfulness isn't, like, on their agenda." Let's just concede from the outset that people might think I'm weird is not, sadly, a myth, as the case of Congressman Ryan illustrates. However, in this chapter, we will show you how the stigma is fading as the practice is put to use in some surprising places. We will also arm you with arguments to make against Neanderthals who mock you for meditating. Finally, and this is the real twist, we'll demonstrate that once you start practicing, you may not care so much what other people think. Mindfulness can help us see into the insecurities, assumptions, and storylines that dominate much of how we act. As this happens, to quote Jeff, we learn to take a stand in values that are actually truer to who we are. And if that looks weird, who gives a shit? Not that this is always easy. Despite my status as an advocate for meditation, I have a long and still active struggle with the optics of the practice. During the 10% Happier publicity tour, I wouldn't let any of the news outlets photograph me meditating because I thought it might make me look weird. I have softened on that, but I still get self-conscious whenever I have to meditate in public, as Jeff and I had been doing quite frequently on the road trip. I wear shades when I meditate in the backseat of taxis and hope the drivers think I'm sleeping. I even feel sheepish when I run into coworkers at the ABC News meditation room, which, in a sign of how far meditation has come, was established entirely without my input. It feels a bit like running into someone you know in the proctologist's waiting room. As it happened, the reason Jeff and I were in Congressman Ryan's office on this, day three of our cross-country odyssey, was that the people we were initially supposed to interview had bailed on us for fear of looking weird. Our original plan for today was to go to Shenandoah National Park, 200,000 acres of protected land just 75 miles from the nation's capital. For weeks, everything seemed copacetic. We had 8 meditation-curious park workers, one of whom was in her 80s, set to join us for an interview about the obstacles to meditation. Then, 4 days before our visit, park officials started to get twitchy. "Is there a religious affiliation with meditation?" one of them called and asked. Suddenly, we would need clearance from their bosses in Washington. Then yesterday at 4 p.m., right as we were getting ready for the Newton event, a park official called to say they were canceling, in part because they didn't want to show their people, especially park rangers in uniform, meditating. "We can't endorse that," they said. I frantically emailed the congressman, explained the situation, and asked if he could cram us into his schedule for an interview. He wrote back right away saying he'd be happy to have us. Interestingly, even as a kid growing up in Ohio, Tim never thought meditation was strange. He would see football coaches at his Catholic school sneaking into the chapel for prayer and meditation. "Men, role models for a boy. That stuck with me," he said. In his 20s, he read a book by legendary basketball coach Phil Jackson, who introduced meditation to members of the Chicago Bulls and the LA Lakers during their epic championship runs. "So that was an influence," Tim told us. I said, "What's this stuff he's doing with his players? What's Michael Jordan doing? Because as a young kid growing up, you think, I want to be like them." Intrigued, he asked a priest he knew to teach him how to do centering prayer, a form of meditation that involves silently repeating to yourself phrases from the Bible or spiritual words such as love or Jesus. He didn't get serious about meditation, however, until the year 2008, in his late 30s and 5 years into his career in the U.S. Congress, when he had a personal crisis. "I was really getting to the point where I was almost burnt out. Elections, Ohio, fundraising. I was just like, I gotta do something." So he went on a 5-day meditation retreat led by Jon Kabat-Zinn, a former MIT molecular biologist who had designed something called mindfulness-based stress reduction, a protocol for teaching meditation in a secular context. "That's what appealed to me," said Tim. "I didn't have to give up my religion, and I didn't have to join some group or put on a robe or do anything funky." Toward the end of the retreat, as the group was engaged in increasingly long periods of silent meditation, Tim says he had a profound experience. "That's when just the top flipped off my head. I was just like, this is unbelievable. You could start really seeing your thoughts come, really understanding what was going on. Then you become aware of why you have high blood pressure. Like, I keep thinking these negative thoughts over and over and over again, and you wonder why you're stressed out." This is, of course, one of the prime benefits of meditation. Things that have been churning in your subconscious get dragged into the open so you can see them clearly and not be governed by them. "It's like the person who has road rage," said Tim. "You pull in front of them because you need to change lanes, and they go ballistic. I mean, obviously, it's not just about you pulling in front of them. There's got to be layers and layers and layers of stuff that happened that day, that week, that month, that year, that lifetime, that get expressed in that moment. When you stop and calm your mind down, you start seeing those things. You start to respond better to them." He was telling us this story while leaning back in a comfy chair in his office, which had the usual American flags, elaborate molding, and old world drapery, and was also filled with books with titles such as Where's My Zen?, Options, Meditation in the Classroom, and Jesus and Buddha. Jeff and I were on a couch diagonal to him. From my point of view, the meditation certainly seemed to be working for Tim. He looked exceedingly calm, especially for a guy whose party was currently in the minority in both houses of Congress. He said, "I don't know how to do it without this, the practice. I'd be like, I'm out. I'm going to go private sector. I'm going to go coach football in Youngstown." Tim had become so convinced of the utility of mindfulness that he, too, had taken on the role of evangelist. He'd written a book, A Mindful Nation, about how meditation could transform key areas of government policy,